Support for WGTD's morning show comes from Jack Andrea, featuring unique shopping and historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since 1911, modernized for a new age. Visit jackandrea.com for more information.
On today's morning show, you're going to be hearing about the groundbreaking work of a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter named Elliot Jaspin, who was able to uncover an almost unspeakable element in our own country's history, recurring incidents of what can only be described as racial cleansing, in which entire communities and sometimes entire counties would be systematically rid of their black residents. Elliot Jaspin's book about this is titled Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. I began my interview with Elliot Jaspin by asking him to describe the way in which he first became aware of this troubling reality in our country's history.
Well, at the time I was working on a story on food safety, and there was a chicken processing plant in this little town of Berryville, Arkansas. And I'd been there for about a day and a half, and I had some time to kill. So I went into a local history museum just to poke around. And on the wall I saw this picture from the 1850s of a farmer and his wife, and underneath the picture was the man's will. So I'm reading the will, and a few lines down it says, "And to my beloved wife, Bessie, I leave my 5 slaves." My first response was one of shock. Every time you come across the artifacts of slavery, it's just a really wrenching experience.
Yeah, I mean, we all know that slavery existed and was a terrible thing, but nonetheless, when we see these sort of tangible reminders of what once upon a time was just sort of a given part of life in America, it is, I'm sure, as you say, kind of a wrenching, jarring sort of experience.
But the other thing that struck me, I had been there, as I said, for about a day and a half, and I hadn't seen any black faces. And reading the will, it was obvious that there had been blacks living in the area. They had been slaves. And so for the next few days, while I was going from interview to interview, I looked for some, you know, evidence of any blacks living in the community, saw nothing. So on the last day, and it was the last interview, in fact, it was the last question, I asked this woman, "By the way, I've been here for several days now, I haven't seen any blacks, how come?" She said, "Oh, the Klan keeps them out." And I was like, "Oh, okay."
And she said it that offhandedly?
Absolutely. It was as if, you know, she was giving directions to the next bus stop. So when I got back to Washington, I was curious, and I got a hold of the 1990 census data, and because I can view it electronically, I asked to see all the counties in Arkansas that were white or virtually all white. To my surprise, about a third came up.
One-third of the counties in Arkansas had very, very small African-American populations.
Either small or non-existent. And this is really bizarre. So then I expanded the search to the south, and more counties came piling out. Then I went further north, and the list grew even longer. And I had no idea what I was looking at, but it just seemed improbable. I was talking with someone who worked at the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, which is owned by Cox Newspapers, and they had come up to the bureau. And I mentioned, you know, that I was looking at this stuff, and it didn't seem to make sense. And she said, well, you know, Forsyth County, which is just north of Atlanta, Forsyth County, they ran all the blacks out. Well, I'd never heard this. And so I wrote a small computer program to look at historical census data and see if I could find where there was a, what I call a black population collapse, where between two census, there's a drop of 50% or greater in the black population. Again, I thought maybe I'd find two or three counties. In fact, there were over 200 counties that came out of the computer. And it was at that point that I began to realize that I was looking at something much, much larger than I'd ever imagined.
In fact, you say in the introduction that you honestly thought you had made some sort of mistake. I mean, you kind of retraced your steps, thinking surely this computer is spitting out something other than what I have specifically asked for. But indeed, there they were, dozens upon dozens upon dozens of counties, which showed this bewildering phenomenon in terms of African-American population.
Then the next thing I did was, and I went from county to county, trying to figure out what took place. Now, in some places, you know, there was some perfectly innocent explanation for the drop. You know, the mine played out, or they redrew the county boundaries, or something like that. But then I began finding the evidence in old newspaper clips of whites rioting and ordering all the blacks out of the county.
You talk so movingly, really, in your introduction about what sounds like, you know, kind of the first moment that you really saw truly tangible confirmation of this. You were watching microfilm, I think, at the time.
Right.
And sort of turning that old crank and seeing pages of newspapers go by on the screen, and then you see a headline which really told the story.
Right.
All Negroes driven from Indiana town.
And it was, at the time, it was front page news. And then, very, very quickly, it just disappeared. And you would talk to people, and they'd say, we know nothing about it. And or they would deny anything had ever happened. But the evidence was still there.
Mm. We're speaking with Elliot Jaspin. We are talking about his book called Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. You say the counties where racial cleansings occurred form a rough arc that begins in North Carolina, crosses the Appalachians, and extends into the Midwest. Can you help us understand that part of this? The reason why we see this in this sort of sweeping arc through the heart of the country?
Well, one of the things that was interesting was that in the Deep South, states like Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, I didn't find a single black population collapse, much less a racial cleansing. And after a couple of years of researching this, it became clear why. Counties where there was a racial cleansing typically were counties where there was a relatively small black population. And that makes kind of sense because, first, it's obviously a lot easier to terrorize a small group of people than it is a large group of people. But I think more importantly, if the black population was critical to the economy of the community. For example, they pick the crops or they hoed the field or whatever. Driving off your labor force was basically shooting yourself in the foot. So the counties where this occurred were rural, mountainous, with a relatively small black population. And so they could drive out the black population, and it wouldn't hurt them economically.
Hmm. So that's why this phenomenon occurs just to the north of those states of the Deep South.
Right.
It's in these states where in a sense, it makes a little more kind of economic sense, if we want to put it in those sorts of terms. You specifically in this book focus on racial cleansings that emptied entire counties. But we should talk for a moment about the fact that what we are talking about surely occurred on a more limited scale as well over, I mean, and in a sense, in much more widespread fashion, that is with towns and villages and individual communities experiencing this as well. Just talk for a moment about that and what, if anything, we really know about that.
Well, the book details 12 counties where there were racial cleansings. And the reason it's counties is an artifact of the data. In other words, the historical census data goes down to the county level. So in trying to find these black population collapses, I had to stop at the county level because the data below that does not exist in electronic form. The other thing, which I think is worth mentioning here, is that I limited it to counties where there were successful racial cleansings, which is to say that the counties remain white or virtually all white today. And the reason I did that was because I had so many that I had to in some way limit this, or I'd still be researching it. Now, when I went through the old newspapers looking for evidence of these racial cleansings, I would come across racial cleansings that occurred on the village, the city, the town level. So, for example, Marion, Ohio, drove out all its blacks. Hamilton, Ohio, drove out all its blacks. Montlake, Tennessee, the one that's very, very famous is Rosewood, Florida, a small town in Florida, again, drove out all its blacks. The history of this has really, we're just beginning to understand what took place. And the scope of this is far larger than just the 12 counties that I wrote about.
Right. I also wonder if we can't probably even point, although I should think this would be in more major metropolitan areas, to racial cleansing occurring in different forms, even on a neighborhood level. That is a certain part of town where the blacks might have begun encroaching on a white population, in a sense, might have been forcibly removed.
Entirely possible. It's at some point, though, you have to draw, I think, some fairly narrow parameters in terms of what you're going to call a racial cleansing. And one of the things that I was concerned about was that the book would be unassailable. And so I used as the geographic unit, obviously, counties. And it couldn't have happened naturally or, you know, or by happenstance. In fact, I required that there be proof of an ultimatum being delivered from the white community to the black community saying, you know, you must leave in 24 hours or 48 hours or we will kill you.
Hmm. You mentioned also that in certain cases you made certain that there hadn't been some sort of logical explanation for something, maybe an economic calamity, which could have perhaps galvanized such an exodus of a given population. Did you find instances in which there was a relatively innocent explanation such as that?
Oh, yeah. One of the, in some ways, most interesting one was I saw this whole line of counties in Arkansas where there appeared to be racial cleansings, where there was like a sudden drop in the black population. And I mean, it was really, really dramatic. And what I found was that they had been building a railroad line through these counties, and they had imported black workers to build the railroad line. So the census comes along, and there are black workers there, so they're counted in the census, you know, 200-300 men. And then after they finish building the railroad line, they move on. And 10 years later, when the census comes back, suddenly there's a drop in the black population. Well, all I was looking at was the building of a railroad line.
You've explained well why you are dealing at the county level with this. I mean, that is where the statistical paper trail, in a sense, ends. When these racial cleansings occurred, and we'll talk, of course, much more in detail about how they were carried out, but were they, in fact, carried out on a county level? I mean, do we have evidence that those who carried this out wanted their entire county cleansed, or were they, in a sense, more interested in just that maybe central community within the county and in effect then essentially rid the county of most of the African Americans? I mean, do you understand what I'm saying? Were they thinking on a county-wide level when these kinds of cleansings took place?
In some counties, it's very, very clear that, yes, that's what they were thinking about. So, for example, Comanche County, Texas, they saw themselves, their world, as bounded by a county. And it was very, very clear that they were going to go through the county and run every black out. And they struck communities, black communities, throughout the county and warned them that they had to leave. In other cases, what happened was that in every county there was a major trading center, typically the county seat. And so when you had a racial cleansing in that county seat and drove all the blacks out, it made it impossible for blacks to live in the county, period. So, for example, Lawrence County, Missouri, Pierce City was the trading center. And when all the blacks were driven out of there, if you were a black living, let's say, in a remote farm, where did you go to get a doctor? Where did you go to buy your food or to get farm implements? Where did you go to get buried? Where was the church? It had all been wiped away. And so it made living in that county, if you were black, virtually impossible.
I suppose a way to understand that would be if a bunch of whites went to a black family in a small town and said, "We'll let you stay here, but you can't set foot in any of the stores," or something like that, in which life would be all but impossible under those circumstances. And in a sense, when you remove the county seat and all which it contains, makes when you render that unavailable, then it doesn't make sense to remain.
Mm-hmm. It makes life impossible for you.
Hmm. You also talk about how when we look at some of the maps of this part of the country within this arc where this kind of cleansing occurred, that we see some really odd designs. I think you call it at one point sort of the donut hole. That is, there will be a county where this will have taken place surrounded by other counties in which the population of African Americans is much higher. Explain that just for a moment and what that tells us about this phenomenon.
Well, a great example of that is Forsyth County, Georgia, where when you today look at the demographics of that region, you'll see there's the Forsyth County with a very, very small black population. In 2000, it was under 1,000 people in that county. And this is close to 100 years after the racial cleansing that occurred there. And then in surrounding counties, you'll see what I'm going to call a normal black population. you'll see thousands of blacks living in the surrounding counties. So Forsyth County is kind of the hole in the middle of the donut. And when you're looking for these racial cleansings, that's a very typical pattern. And it's one of the tip-offs that you need to look a little closer.
We're speaking with Elliot Jaspin. We're talking about his book called Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. One thing that is especially odd about this, which you point out to us, is that when we are talking about racial cleansing and these kind of incidents in which African Americans were forced from their homes, that this would play out in various ways, and often in ways which involved little or absolutely no bloodshed. I mean, no deaths. I mean, when we hear about this, we immediately think about bloodthirsty mobs and this being carried out in very violent fashion. In fact, one of the most sinister faces of this is that sometimes this occurred, in a sense, very quietly. Talk for a moment about that.
Well, it was an attempt to terrorize people, and how you terrorize them, ran the gamut from killing them through torturing them. In one case, in Kentucky, they rounded up about a dozen blacks and tortured them for about an hour, and then said, we're going to be back, so you'd better leave, or we'll do this again. Where they would just issue an ultimatum. And for example, in Vermilion County, Indiana, the word went around to the black community. In fact, the whites held a meeting and said, you have to be gone by Wednesday, I think it was. And, blacks realized the writing was on the wall. And it was that implied threat of violence was sufficient for them to flee for their lives. It was all that it took.
One thing that makes this so very, very curious is that this occurred so often in so many different places, and yet remained and remains so hidden from public view and is so conspicuously absent from the historical record. First of all, can we trace that veil of secrecy to the same cause, or is this obscure in our history for different reasons?
When you say to the same cause, what exactly do you mean?
Well, I mean there are probably different explanations for why this was talked about so little, or why it is so little remembered, why it is not in our history books, why it is not necessarily talked about all that much. I mean, is it for different reasons in different places that this is such an unknown part of our history?
No, I think it. What I found was that it was pretty consistent. Initially, after these racial cleansings occurred, whites would see them as a positive social benefit. So, for example, in Boone County, Arkansas, the Chamber of Commerce advertised its community, and one of the selling points for the community was that there were, and they put it in their brochure, that we have neither mosquitoes nor Negroes. I mean, and in Monette, Missouri, on their official town stationery, they crowed that this is a town that is all white.
So at the time, in the immediate wake of this, a town would be proud of this and publicize this in the same way that if they had driven out rats from the village marketplace or
exactly.
Or some other pest. This was seen as a positive thing and not kept secret, really.
Right. But then, as the times changed, the attitudes changed as well. And began to be seen as what it was, which was just a terrible, terrible thing. And what happened then was that the whites in these communities would create what I call fables. And this was a story that would, whose whole intent was to absolve the white community of any guilt for what had occurred. And typically the fable was formulated to show that, well, yes, this had happened, it was done in an exemplary fashion, no one was really hurt, and if no one was hurt, then there was really no harm, and if there's no harm, therefore there's no foul, so we don't need to talk about it. They would either do that, or they would simply deny that it ever took place. And so, for example, in Corbin, Kentucky, where in a 24-hour period, mobs rounded up blacks at gunpoint, marched them to the train station and put them on trains and sent them packing. The town to this day claims that never took place. It just never happened. This helped to hide the fact that this had occurred. The other side of the equation was that within the black community, and this was a huge surprise to me, there was, among the descendants of those driven out, there's this lingering sense of shame. Now, I want to emphasize here, the people who were driven out were absolutely innocent. They had done nothing wrong. But the fact that they had been driven out implied that there was something wrong with them. And so, for example, in Forsyth County, one of the men who was driven out would tell anybody who asked that he was actually from Chicago. He'd never been to Forsyth County.
Hmm.
So you have this kind of conspiracy of silence on both sides. And it's a conspiracy that continues to this day.
You talk about, for instance, how in many African American families, they might know enough to say to someone, "Oh no, you don't want to move to Forsyth County, Georgia. Mm-hmm. You really don't." But they wouldn't know exactly why not. I mean, they would not really know in any sense, in any detail whatsoever, what had transpired there. Really only just that something very bad had happened there once upon a time, and that means even to this very day that this is a place where a black family should not attempt to live.
In fact, what I found was that this warning is actually a rite of passage in black families.
Oh, yes, you call it the speech.
Right. Child gets his or her driver's license, and typically what happens is they're sat down by their parents, and they're told two things. First is, here's what you do when you're stopped by the police. And then the other thing is, these are the places you do not go, because they're just too dangerous. And that is how the information is passed along. And many times, there'll be a town on the list, and no one will know why, but they just know that that's a dangerous place. And in fact, after the book was published, I've gotten emails from people who thanked me, saying, you know, my father told me that such and such place was always dangerous, and I never knew why. And thanks for explaining this. It's the tradition, the oral tradition, passes it down, but it gets fuzzed and blurred.
We're speaking with Elliot Jaspin about his book, Buried in the Bitter Waters, The Hidden History of Racial Cleansing in America. In trying to help us understand what may have driven whites to do this time and time again, one of the points you make, which had not really dawned on me, was in pointing to this idea of segregation and the fact that in places where the races were rather clearly, cleanly segregated from one another, that very segregation often fostered what you call increasingly bizarre fantasies. I mean, terrifying fantasies amongst at least some of the whites. Talk for a moment about some of the ways in which that would play out and contribute ultimately to these disturbing events.
Well, in doing the research to find the evidence of these racial cleansings, what I would have to do is take a newspaper and go through it literally day by day, looking for the story about blacks being driven out of X or Y place. And as I did that, I would come across these really strange stories about where whites would comment on blacks. And that's when I saw this racial paranoia, which is just staggering. It would play out in a number of ways. For example, Pierce City, Missouri, they drove out the blacks in one just terrible night of violence. But then they imagined that there was this black army that was forming on outside of town. And on a Thursday night, the racial cleansing occurred on Monday night. On Thursday night, there was this rumor that swept through town that the blacks were coming over the hills and this black army was about to attack us. They literally called out the National Guard to protect them from this phantom army. And, you know, nothing could have been further from the truth. You read the newspaper stories and you just get these absolutely weird views of what whites thought of blacks. So, for example, in southern Indiana, there was this story where the guy was saying with great confidence, you know, there are different classes of Negroes, and he says, and then there is the blue gum nigger whose bite is poisonous. I mean, it's just scary.
Right. I mean, scary that people could concoct such fantasies.
Yeah.
Or that blacks had unrestrained sexual appetites, which, of course, leads into one of the most common aspects of this, namely that sometimes these cleansings would seem to be galvanized by an incident in which apparently, supposedly, an African-American man had perhaps attacked or even raped a white woman. And that's one of the most interesting things in the book, is you attempt, of course, many, many, many years later, to get at the heart of those kind of incidents and the truth, if any, behind them.
Yeah, and it came down sort of 50-50. Sometimes, in fact, a black man had assaulted or killed a white woman. But there were some cases where it was obvious that it just hadn't happened. And one of the most... it was almost gothic experiences I had was in Mitchell County, North Carolina, where I interviewed one of the descendants of the woman who claimed that she had been raped. And we're sitting there in this sunny porch of her home, a beautiful place, and she said, well, the story within her family is that grandma wasn't raped. In fact, she just got scared. And the man she accused of raping her was tried. He was convicted. They spent 5 minutes electrocuting him. The blacks in the county were driven out. The National Guard was called in, and yet there the family saying, "Well, no, it actually never really happened."
Echoes of To Kill a Mockingbird. One thing that you point out is that some of this perhaps is traced to a really important moment in our history, which probably a lot of us as Americans have largely forgotten about or are certainly hazy on the details, and that is the Dred Scott decision back in 1857. Tell us why this is an important factor in sparking some of these incidents.
Well, there's always in each of these racial cleansings that I examine, there's always something like a rape, a murder, some triggering event. But really, what's taking place here is far more fundamental. In the Dred Scott decision, one of the things that the Supreme Court ruled was that Negroes, by the very fact of being Negroes, could not be citizens, that this was a country of, for, and by white men. What that meant had an impact far beyond just sort of the political calculation. Obviously, if you couldn't be a citizen, you didn't have the right to vote. And in fact, after Reconstruction, blacks were stripped of the right to vote. And if you didn't have the right to vote, if you were not a citizen, then you didn't belong to the community socially. And if you didn't belong there, then it was permissible to get rid of you, to run you off.
Hmm. Yes, you said if when we are looking at the African Americans among us as guests, and not in a benevolent way, but as guests who should behave, and who, when they don't behave in our home, we certainly have the right to turn them out. I mean, that, in a sense, in a twisted way, gives you license to do all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. when you are thinking of them not as fellow citizens in the same town, but as guests there at your pleasure and discretion.
And then if you pile on top of that the idea that these guests are these, strange, dangerous creatures, driving them out is a social benefit. Hmm. It improves your community.
You do mention in the book's introduction and throughout the heart of the book when you examine these 12 specific incidents that there are at least some cases in which there was opposition to this being done. One of the most intriguing examples of that is the racial cleansing which occurred in Comanche County, Texas, back in 1886, an incident in which you say the white community there was really torn apart. Tell us about that.
Well, the common or popular notion is that there was white hegemony there, that there was a solid body of opinion that this or that needed to happen. And in fact, that was not the case, and not just in Comanche County, Texas, but in a number of these racial cleansings. The community was really split. The whites in town who lived next to, worked with, were friends with their black neighbors, when they were told that, you know, all blacks had to leave, were furious. And in fact, they held a mass meeting, passed a resolution denouncing the idea. And it was a battle between the townspeople, where most of the blacks lived, and the farmers in the surrounding area who lived on farms and did not see or have any dealings with blacks on a day-to-day basis. And one of the sad things about this is when they designed the fables to absolve themselves of guilt, one of the things that they did was they obliterated the history of the heroes in their community, the people who, at times of great moral crisis, such as a racial cleansing, stood up and said, no, this is wrong, and fought the mob. Well, those people, those heroes, the people that we should celebrate today, their histories have been destroyed.
Hmm. Another interesting facet in this particular incident, and this is not the only place we read this kind of story, but as I read about these cleansings, one of the most intriguing things to me was What about those cases, those counties in which, I mean, we're talking about a population sometimes in which at first there were 2,000 blacks, and then 3 years later there are 12. I mean, sometimes we're talking about a plunge of that. One of the things you wonder about is, what about those 12? Or what about those 4? Or what about the 1 African-American who chooses to remain, or maybe for some reason just can't leave, doesn't have the wherewithal to leave, does not leave? What is life like for them? And if it is a conscious decision, a conscious choice they are making to remain, what is that motivation and what is the experience like for them? And the way this plays out in Comanche, Texas, is particularly interesting with a black family that you come to know.
Well, there's actually, that is a really interesting point, and it's something I didn't get into in great detail in the book, but which I came across is, as I was going through these old newspapers, I would come across these just really bizarre little stories about sort of like social notes that Mr. and Mrs. Smith came into town to yesterday with their loyal retainer, you know, Rufus. And then they'll talk about that Rufus was an ex-slave and he's one of those good old-time Negroes who knows his place. And hooray for Rufus, that sort of thing. And the impression you get is that there were a group of people, and it sounds awfully harsh, but this is how the whites viewed them. They were sort of like pet Negroes. And you will find in the old newspaper accounts that they're treated, you know, sort of like as kind of the loyal lapdog. When there are these racial cleansings, occasionally the white community would decide that there were two or three of these pet Negroes who would be allowed to stay. So, for example, in Corbin, Kentucky, there was all the blacks were driven out except for three. And they were, my impression was, they were extremely old. And one in particular was known throughout town as Nigger Dennis, and, you know, and he was just sort of accepted as part of the community, as harmless and kind of the loyal retainer. Now, their lives didn't change all that much because they were seen as absolutely harmless and kind of not a problem, not a threat. Again, they were the pet Negro. Later on, these communities, blacks would try to move back into these communities. So in Comanche County, Texas, after about 100 years, I found this black family that tried to live in Comanche County. And in fact, they spent 15 or 20 years there and raised their daughters. And what was fascinating was that they were met initially with tremendous hostility. And one of the daughters told me how she would come home from elementary school and ask her mom, what's a nigger? And mom would explain that, you know, that the other kids were, you know, just teasing her and not to worry about it. But she had no idea of why she was being picked on. She goes from that and from being picked on by the other kids because she was different to she was a tremendous athlete. By the time she graduated from high school, she was a star athlete on the winning women's basketball team in town. And in fact, they wound up parading her and the rest of the team through town after they won the state championship. So she goes from, you know, being called, you know, nigger on the basketball court by the fans when she started out her career, to being, a celebrity in town. But then the color line in these counties is still maintained. And so after she graduates and goes off to college, she told me she came back 6 months later. And as she's driving through town, she starts being followed by the police, because the police in Comanche County, Texas, will check out any black driving through the county to make sure they don't stop, that they move on. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, even though she'd lived there for 20 years, the color line is maintained.
And when you pose the question, why did they for so long hang on in Comanche, putting up with so much? And Nicole's mother says, I stayed because they didn't want me to.
Yeah, she's an amazing person.
There are a lot of amazing stories in this book. In just the 2 minutes or so that remain, I would like you to talk briefly about another story that you tell in this book at the end, namely about, in some sense, the professional cost to you in telling this story as honestly as you want, as you wanted to. I mean, one of the really disturbing things we read about is the resistance with certain newspaper editors in the South to having this story told as you wanted to tell it. Just tell us very briefly about that.
Well, I talked about the fable, and the fable in Forsyth County, Georgia, was that, yeah, we drove the blacks out, but we paid them for their land. And if we paid them for their land, then there was no harm, no foul. We did nothing wrong. And it's very, very important that the community defend the fable. When I was writing, was researching the history of this in Forsyth County, I started looking at the newspaper accounts of race relations in Forsyth County. And these stories were written by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, a Cox newspaper, and I worked for Cox Newspapers. And it became very, very clear that the AJC saw its role as defending this fable. So, for example, in 1987, they did a front-page story in which the racial cleansing was called a legend, and they repeated the lie, which it was, that all the blacks had been, you know, compensated for their land. In fact, I went through every piece of black-owned land in Forsyth County and found out that the majority had basically their land stolen. When I wrote about this in my the newspaper series that I was preparing for Cox Newspapers, the editors in Atlanta just went bonkers. And I'll spare you the long story of this, except that they refused to run even one word of the series. And the editor, my immediate boss here, looked at me and says, well, yeah, I think we both know what's going on here. They don't want to anger white people. Ironically, the editor in Atlanta who led the charge against the series, a guy named Hank Klibanoff, went on this year to win a Pulitzer for her book on... he wrote with another man on how race was covered during the 50s and the 60s. The end result, I refused to go along with what I consider to be a cover-up, and so I've been demoted at Cox.
Hmm. Yet another sad chapter in an amazing and important story called Buried in the Bitter Waters, published by Basic Books. Elliot Jaspin, I thank you for this really important book and for joining me on the morning show to talk about it. Best wishes to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Tomorrow on the morning show, weather permitting, we will have Dr. Art Sear joining us from Carthage College to offer his analysis of current events. Wednesday, again, weather permitting, Dr. Jerry Mast, political science professor, talking about the Democratic field for seeking a presidential nominee for 2020. Support for WGTD comes from Jack Andrea. featuring unique shopping, and the historic Jack's Cafe, featuring an eclectic menu. A Kenosha tradition since